Welcome to Failing Up. We don't have a theme song.
Well, we might not have a theme song, Eden, but we do have a theme, and that is failure.
And we talk to people about their failures and mistakes and how they grew from it.
Simple as that. Listen up.
Thank you for coming to Failing Up.
Coming?
Right. I don't know. You know what? People have to come to their phones or their device and click on it.
That's true.
You know, so they're coming over. It's a lot of steps. You know, when someone tells me they listen to a podcast, I'm impressed.
Really?
It's, yeah.
Okay.
I am too. I don't buy it. I just don't even believe it.
For the most part, I don't either because I don't listen to a lot of podcasts. But I seriously, like even as a podcaster, I've been podcasting since 2008.
Yeah.
I listen to very, very few podcasts. And it's probably Howard Stern's fault. If there was no Howard Stern, I might be more of a podcast guy. But I'm always surprised when people are very like, oh, that's all I listen to is podcasts.
It's not all I listen to. It's good to have music.
But... Well, yes. But okay. So, but that is where you get your like talk is from podcasts.
I used to, when I was living alone, I still live alone, but I used to have like Seinfeld in the background and now I have podcasts in the background. Huh.
Right. Just like your roommate, your friendly roommate, just making noise in the BG.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the office.
It makes you feel comfortable. Office. Yeah.
Just put it in the background. I could do whatever. Sometimes I edit the show.
And they don't eat your food by accident. They don't bring someone over.
That's true. Don't change the channel on the TV.
They don't clean, which kind of sucks.
That does suck. But, yeah. So, Eden, maybe, and I feel like we kind of started and then went back, like we kind of skipped over the part where we introduce our guests.
Sorry. Yes.
No need.
A man who needs no introduction. Let's proceed.
Guys, we have Jay Duplass here today.
Hi.
Wow, listen to that applause. Amazing.
Is there an applause?
You're always surprised when you hear the applause.
Oh, because you edited it.
Eden, you're not supposed to... You're supposed to act like it's always really there.
I don't know. We're not a live show today. So
you guys piping in applause?
Oh, always. Oh, that's part of the fun.
Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love
it.
We're going to throw in a little extra right here.
Because, I got to bring the vibe up. If there's applause, the vibe's going to have to come up.
Way up.
It's, feel it? Yeah. You feel it coming? There's a little bit of a smile.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa. Yeah, yeah. Oh,
it's
yeah.
In there.
Good times.
Hey, we did it.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks
so good
for
to
having
have you.
Me.
I guess we should start from the beginning, as we always do here. We here at Failing Up talk about failures and how they shaped our success.
Yeah, that's mostly what I got is failures.
And I honestly think you cannot be successful without failing and making mistakes.
True.
Or at least you're not really good, I feel, like unless you learn.
The people who like do really well right off the bat, they usually, it turns into a shit show.
Or you just hate them.
Quick after. Or you hate their guts. They're irrelevant to me and most humans, so fuck them.
Yeah. I mean, there's always one person, though, I think. I was just speaking to somebody else about this person who, at least when, I believe we interviewed him and asked him this question, and he said he's a comedian, part of it, and he's never bombed. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Trayvon.
Oh,
Free.
Trayvon Free, okay.
He said he's never bombed. And I'm like, well, then he's never felt that he's never failed.
He's not risking enough.
But is he not risking enough? I don't know.
I don't know.
Or is it actually possible to just start at success and continue at success?
Maybe he's
for a few people, maybe.
He's just been positive and is just like, that's not bombing.
That's kind of exactly what the other person told me, who's also a comedian. They were like, no, maybe he bombed, but he just has a different outlook on what bombing is.
Right.
So whatever he's doing or drinking or smoking, I'll take it. If he thinks that he didn't bomb, but everyone else thinks he bombed. I mean, that's called you got it made, basically.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms.
That's called therapy.
It might be.
It's like, you're doing okay, man. So let's start from the beginning. So you grew up in Louisiana.
Yeah, I grew up in New Orleans in a first suburb of New Orleans called Metairie. And I grew up like a few houses off of this lake there. It was very idyllic. New Orleans culture was around us, but we were just kind of like riding bikes and, you know, there was no TV and there was no toys. There was nothing. It was just like making up life.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like really bored. Kind of generating all your own entertainment, all that stuff.
And are you out in the bayou or where are you?
I'm in New Orleans. I mean, we were probably 7 minutes from downtown.
Okay.
But it was a suburb, but there were also two strip clubs 2 blocks from our house. So I don't really know.
That's all the entertainment you need.
Yes. Yeah. So it was, I don't know. It was kind of a mix, I guess.
Was it a fairly safe neighborhood?
Very safe neighborhood. Okay. things that you were worried about were like snakes and alligators. But right. It wasn't that way. I mean, it was just suburban houses stacked up, you know, like it's formerly middle class America suburb.
How old are you? Well, how old are you when you left Louisiana?
I was there, you know, until I went to college, and then I went to Austin, Texas for college.
Huh. And I'm going to skip back to your childhood a little bit, but I'm kind of wondering, like, you don't have any accent.
No. I'm going to say something super controversial. I think intelligence maybe erases accent after a while.
You know, there was a really...
Is that horrible to say?
There's a great... There's a New York Times, or I think it's New York, or I'm not sure. Something with New York. They did an article about slang and, like, accents.
Yeah.
And what they mean as far as, like, education level and race and all this stuff. And it, like, they surveyed a bunch of people, and it was fascinating.
I was mostly joking with that. I think it might have more to do, honestly, with television watching.
I didn't watch much TV growing up.
Well, not until 1983 when cable arrived. I was 10. Cable arrived in the neighborhood, and then everything changed.
Wow.
That, you know what? We're about the same age, and it was a momentous occasion. I actually remember that my parents were sitting in the backyard, and a guy came around the corner. He had a pamphlet, you know, and they had, what was it? WHT, I think it was. That had a black cat, HBO. And we're like, oh, my God, cable is coming to our neighborhood.
But no one knew what it was. It was just exciting. Like, what, is there going to be a giant cable laid out on our lawn? And then, things are going to come out of it? Like, you had no fucking idea what they were talking about. No. Because, like, prior to cable, I mean, I feel like an old man right now, but, like, TV was not worth watching, period. End of story.
Yeah,
it was like Captain Kangaroo and fucking Fantasy Island. It was, like, terrible, terrible programming.
And Mr. Rogers.
And Mr. Rogers. Well, that was...
That was fine.
That was fine.
Don't you disparage small wonder.
But you also had to, like... be able to go to the TV when it was on. I mean, it was like, it was just something that was like...
You had to get up and change the channel.
I mean, it was just like an item in your house that was, it was not a god yet.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like another thing. Like the radio was used just as much, if not more.
Yeah.
Like the radio was on.
For sure.
A phone was there. Yeah. Didn't mean that much. Computers didn't exist. I mean, it was like, you know... You're just living in a box.
So with like getting cable, like exciting and like...
It was very exciting. And then it was better than I thought it could be because it delivered naked boobs at 3 p.m.
Oh.
At 3 p.m.?
Oh, it was uncurated at that time.
What?
Huh. You would like come home from school and watch like Ordinary People followed by like Silkwood, followed by like Convoy.
That would be HBO,
Yes, HBO.
But then there was the other thing where there was porn, but... Unless you actually paid for it, it was scrambled. So like you would switch over and for a second you'd see a boob.
Scrambled boob. It was usually squiggly and purple and green.
Correct.
And it was plenty.
Yeah.
There was no face attached to the boob.
But that's probably better.
But 12-year-old boys, like you don't need a face.
Oh, hell no.
You need like a bent boob and maybe like a leg with like a little bit of hair showing up somewhere, and you were just like,
absolutely,
this is porn. Yeah, that was.
And then when you're like, you see a real boob, you're like, this isn't squiggly.
Yes, this is nor is it green or purple.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I've been I'm not sure I'm ready for this.
It's like, wow, this is too much realism right here.
Yeah,
wow.
It's too much.
Crazy.
Do you remember like the first TV show on cable that you were like, wow, I love this show?
It wasn't TV shows. It was like strictly HBO adult programming, not like porn programming, but just rated R, hard-hitting dramas, relationship stuff like Kramer versus Kramer, a divorce drama.
And your parents don't care what you're
they
watching.
They don't care. They don't even know. They don't know what cable is either.
Right.
Oh, really?
You know, they just let us watch it. And we were like weirdly obsessed. And all of our friends were obsessed with like Empire Strikes Back. And I didn't care that much about Empire Strikes Back.
Huh. It sounds like me as a kid. I watched like Pulp Fiction when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And then like my sister's like, you gotta watch Star Wars. That's like the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
I'm like, nah.
No.
Like, no. I want to see.
Let's explore feelings and sex and relationships. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why. It's weird when I think back on it. Why? Because my brother was the same way too. We were just like two boys, like watching hard-hitting relationship dramas.
Yeah.
And like crying and talking about them afterwards.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was like...
That must have been great, though, to have, like, a brother to, like, talk things over with, these, like, feelings about stuff.
Yeah.
Is he,
yeah.
Mark's the older brother?
He's younger. Younger. He's younger seems brother. Older, okay. But he's younger.
I was just telling Guy, we had Ben Lee on last time.
Yes.
And I Ben Lee had a party, and I saw Mark there, and I didn't want to say hi, but I was like, I have your brother in my podcast next week.
We've been playing podcast phone tag for about 3 months. Yeah.
But anyway.
So you're a young man. You're 13. Yeah. From what I've read, it's not a drama, actually, that changes your life. I mean, I guess it's a kind of a dramedy at
Raising Arizona?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it was just the first time that, okay, the cable came and they piped in the movies, sure. And they came into my TV and then into my brain.
Yeah.
But I was just not intelligent or precocious in any way. I was just like, these movies were just given to me. Never thought about where they came from or whatever. You know, you have consciousness about actors.
Right.
But Raising Arizona was the first time I watched a movie and I was like, oh, people made this movie.
Yeah.
A person made this movie. And then it turned out it was two brothers. And so, but it was like, not only am I aware that a person made this movie, but I can sense a lot about them, mm-hmm. because of their voice and what it is. And so that was the first time I was like, who made this? Oh, two brothers made this. Holy shit. They're like 3 years apart. They kind of look like us on some level. Like, is that something someone could do? Nah, you can't do that. Cause in New Orleans, when you're like a hopeful artist, like you're only like, image of an artist is like a 55-year-old black man, like the Neville brothers or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
The coolest people in the world who, like, they drive Cadillacs and they, like, tour France and, like, yeah. You know, play indigenous New Orleans music. And, you know, we tried to be 55 and black and we failed miserably.
It's terrible. It's very difficult, too.
You can still try. There's still time. You're not 55
yet.
Yeah,
we tried. We were part of the late 80s white boy funk movement. You know, like when, like, basically impressive. The Red Hot Chili Peppers came out with, right. Like, Uplift Mofo Party Plan or whatever. You know, we were like, oh,
this is us.
We can do this, too. We can do this, too. And then it was like, nope, you can't. You can't do that. Yeah.
So did you always think that, like, oh, this is an industry I could go in?
Never, ever once thought it. Never in a million years thought it.
Even after Raising Arizona.
Even after Raising Arizona. It was like, oh, but, you know, you figure out that movies cost, like, millions of dollars, mm-hmm. and you have to get approval and all this shit. And it was just so far removed. So we were musicians early on, and we made little movies at our house. And, you know, we played around with movies. But we were, like, pretty serious about music until our early 20s. Like, that was the way we were going to do it.
Hmm. And did you guys always get along?
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
That's pretty
cool. Because I have an older brother, and we don't, like, we've never really gotten along. So I don't understand that relationship.
Mark ascribes it to the fact that I was nice to him.
Yeah.
I, like, included him. I don't know. I just never thought of, like, I don't know. There were kids on the block who would, like, beat the shit out of mm-hmm. their younger siblings.
Right.
And it just didn't appeal to me. I was just like, well, you know.
You're
and
fine.
Plus, like, I could make him do shit and he would do it. And, you know, it was just more.
You didn't have to beat him.
I didn't.
So
and I was,
good.
Like, kind of immature and he was kind of, like, advanced for his age. So we kind of, like, met in the middle.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So perfect symbiotic relationship.
I think my sister realized I could be her little slave. That's why she was like, this is cool. I'm going to use this to my advantage.
Did you guys collaborate? Did you make stuff
Never.
Together?
No. She was not an artistic person. She went on to be a nurse.
Oh. Right.
So, but she was just like, she's a cool little person. We're 15 years apart. So.
Oh, wow. So
yeah.
She's almost like your second mom.
I wouldn't say that. she like left the house early too. So I didn't grow up. I felt like an only child. But it's like, it's great when you can click with your brother. Cause then you have someone to like bounce ideas off of.
I think so. I think there's a lot of sibling teams because it's like, I don't know what it is, but like, You share, especially in comedy, you share a sense of humor with your sibling that is unique, that you created.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think having a sibling gives you the courage to, like, come out with it more and to be bold with it, you know? Because if you have a weird fucking sense of humor, you know, you might be nervous about it or you might be, like, hiding it a little bit or whatever. But, you know, with a sibling, it's
You'll be
like,
candid.
More candid about it. You're like, you have more confidence in it. And I think that helped us throughout the years, just kind of even just doing the entertainment industry. You know what I mean? It's just like having somebody else there who's like, making a shit show of their own life as well is like comforting as you go along.
Totally. Like, I feel like I wish I could do like a Big Sisters, Big Brothers program for like filmmakers and just, you know, creators in Hollywood, just to have someone. Cause I go through days and I hear my friends go through days where like, what am I doing?
What am I doing? Yeah.
They liked it this much. And then this person said no. And should I just give up? And you just need someone in your corner to just be in your corner and like support you and just be like, yeah, your ideas aren't crazy. You know, and so
I mean, those days never end, in my opinion. I mean, I have them all the time. I'm just like, what am I doing? And this is insane.
We have a brother. So,
yeah, it helps. It does help.
So, you guys are in your 20s. You're doing funk music. Funk, is that what you said it was?
Oh, I don't know.
Basically, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
White boy funk. White boy is like metal funk. Okay. Right?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And when, how does the jump happen into writing and into making movies?
Well, We had a fortuitous moment. We've had a couple of fortuitous moments. I mean, I don't know. Part of it is like, if you wait at the bus stop for decades, eventually you're going to catch the bus.
Mm-hmm. Is that true, though?
I mean, do think it is true. You can't just wait at the bus stop. You have to wait at the bus stop and write screenplays.
Right.
But I went to college in Austin in 1991, and in retrospect, it was kind of the birthplace of American DIY filmmaking at that time. Because in 1991, Richard Linklater had Slacker in like the midnight college theater. Hmm. And he would go Q&A the movie every once in a while. And it played for like almost like a year.
Wow.
And it was like, oh, a person made this movie, harkening back to like Raising Arizona.
Right.
And not only is it just a person, but like, I see him walking around town, and he was wearing jeans and a white t-shirt. He was dressed, that was like the uniform in the 90s. It's just like Gap
still
jeans and a white t-shirt. And I was like, oh, he's wearing the same shit as me. And he's also like eating hardly anything, like soup from the school union cafeteria. And I found out that the movie cost him $20,000. Wow. And I was like, that was still an enormous amount of untouchable money to me, but it was a fathomable amount of money. It was just like, oh, $20,000. And then Robert Rodriguez, also from Austin, made El Mariachi, the first movie, that same time. I think he had made it the year before. I can't remember. So we kind of like, and everyone was waking up to that in Austin and being like, oh, we can make movies. We can make movies. And so that's when it started to grow. And I started taking film classes and started sort of getting into the next 10 years of absolute failure.
Let's talk about some of that. So what were some of like films that you made that you think were not great?
Oh, I made,
you want to shove away?
Every movie I made before I was 29 years old was a piece of shit.
Oh, good.
And there were probably 10 to 15 short films, and there were 2 to 3 features.
But okay,
that people don't want to talk about. But it's,
but are they pieces
real
of shit? Like, you obviously put yourself into
shit.
It. Is it just? But it's other people think it's, it might not like it. But
other
it truly,
people know it's.
This is your
shit
baby, right? And you're saying right now, okay, I gave birth to like 20 ugly babies, right?
Yes.
I agree with people now that baby was fucking
pro-choice.
Ugly.
Yes. Yes.
But it's still your baby. So there's no part of you that's like, well, that one, even though it's an ugly baby, I actually thought it was good looking when it came out.
No, I think the only thing that I had going for me is I knew they were ugly babies.
You know what? That's good, because it's like Ira Glass said that a lot of times, like, young people that are creating stuff, they have really good taste and they hate their work because it's just not up to part of their taste yet.
Yeah.
It's not good.
That's the
yet
best case scenario. What I don't actually experience that a lot in a lot of young people. This is very frank, but like, you know, I don't know, because of this movie, The Puffy Chair, which was our first feature that was good, I don't know, it was just like the right movie at the right time. A lot of younger people like sort of like looked up to us and wanted to be us, and you know, it was a $15,000 movie that had theatrical yeah distribution. And the one thing that I have noticed is that people aren't listening to other people when they watch their movie. It's like, if everyone is not interested in your movie and no one is asking you what you're going to do next and no one's super excited about your movie and you are, your movie sucks and you're not aware of it. And I think that's really, like, it's so hard to make a good movie. There's so many skills that you have to synthesize to do it. And people are like, have unrealistic expectations, I think. You know what I mean? It's like, because we all watch movies, we live and deal in the currency of movies. We think that the myth is that you're going to wake up one morning, you're going to make a movie or write a movie, and it's either going to be great or bad, and that determines whether or not you are a good or a bad filmmaker or a writer or whatever. Right. And it's so not true. I mean, it's like, no one would expect a painter to sell their first painting. You have to make 1,000 paintings before you could even consider being paid.
Yeah.
But like, everyone thinks their first movie is going to be great. And I think you need to make a bunch of pieces of shit, and hopefully you get lucky and it doesn't take you 20 like it did for me, but it took me 20 and it took me 10 years and I was on the verge of, you know, a lot of sad things, you know, like I was 29 and all my friends were like getting married and getting great jobs and putting it down payments on houses. And I was like making $15,000 a year at a temp job and eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches every day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you know?
Right.
How are you even surviving? I mean, out here too.
No, I was in Austin at the time. Okay. And that was the big part of it, is you could live on nothing in Austin and still live a pretty decent life. But it was more the case of like seeing everyone just move past you year after year after year. It was hard.
What kept you going though? Like, was it your brother?
I think my brother was a big part of it. My parents believed in us. Like, they wanted to see us succeed. They were worried about us.
Yeah.
Because I mean, there's a point where like at 18, they want to see you succeed. And at 26, they're like, you could do it. And at 29, they're like,
I definitely had that feeling like, I don't want to let them down. I don't want to like stress them out anymore. I don't want to stress myself out. I don't want to stress my friends out anymore. It was just getting like stressful.
Yeah.
You know? It's just like, how far can you push this before it just becomes like kind of dumb and irresponsible? Because I was a Catholic prep school kid. Like, I went to a Jesuit high school. Like, all my friends were like Ivy League overachieved, you know, and that promise, I mean, I could have been one of those kids, you know, and I wasn't. And it was like, holy shit, what do I have now?
Yeah. Right. I feel like that's so relatable to me, because I feel like, well, my parents died when I was young, or my mom died when I was young, and my dad died when I was like youngish. So I never had the disappointment to worry about.
But
I always felt, but because of that, I always felt like there's no one believing in me, telling me you're good, keep going. And there's also no one telling me you're crazy, something like you have to get a job to like just to get anything that they'll make you money. Like,
you probably grew up a lot quicker, because
I had to.
Because like, as we, now I'm like 45 and I'm just like, oh yeah, none of it really matters. I just have to figure out what my rules are. And sounds like you had to do that super early.
Yeah. And it's just like, and all my, you went to a Jesuit high school. I went to like a Reformed Jewish high school and they all went to Ivy Leagues. And I was like, I want to be in the arts. They're like, no, we're doctors and lawyers.
Yes. That's exactly where I came from.
Yeah. So it was like, you know, and I honestly think though, my parents would have like supported me, you know, had they known what I really, really wanted to do.
Yeah.
My mom was like 8 different jobs that were just really artistic and different, even though she had like an urban planning degree. So I just always thought maybe that was
the way to go.
My dad was like an engineering type, but never wanted to work for a company.
Yeah.
He was always like, I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to start my own company. Like, so I'm going to write my own stuff.
Yes.
I'm not going to listen to other people. This is my thing.
And
then
I have to bring it up again, especially for people who might be listening for the first time. Her father invented wacky waveable arm flailing tube man.
You are kidding
Someone
me.
Someone just posted this to me. They sent me a picture because I went to the show.
My children thank you deeply. They have received so much joy from the dancing
men.
How great is it that you knew exactly what I was talking about?
Of course I know.
Oh,
with the original?
My God.
That's the 4th of July.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He invented for the Atlanta Olympic Games.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, for the closing ceremonies. And then, like, a year later, he's like, this is a dumb invention. I'm going to sell the patent because I need, like, $20,000, like, immediately. I just bought a house. So he sold the patent.
No.
And now I'm an heir to nothing. But every time I pass by a car dealership, people always like text me and be like, I saw your dad's thing. And I'm like,
well, you have some awesome pictures of like your dad making it too.
Yeah. What is the patent of that worth right now?
It's such a little...
Every car dealership in the world
it's
has...
It's such a small, stupid thing, though, that you see and kids love
like
for
post-it
some
notes.
Yeah, like post-it.
You could have been the flailing guy heiress. That's a whole other personality.
And then I wouldn't be like, oh, please make my movie. I would just make my own movies.
You'd make your own movies,
I know. But anyway, I totally relate to that whole, like, everyone's going on. And I was kind of like,
I think everyone has struggled with that on some level because you really have to risk it if you're going to do it. And I think you do have to commit because, I mean, most people that I know that have success in the entertainment industry have it because of persistence. Mm-hmm. That's the primary thing that they have. Because look, not everyone is a director or a writer, director, producer, or whatever the fuck you thought you wanted to be. But if you stick with it, you figure... I mean, I personally feel like I just became an actor like 5 years ago with Transparent, and it's the thing that I was meant to do. But I was like a shy kid, and I didn't... You know, like when you're in high school... If you're shy, like you're not going to be an actor. You have to be like an annoying theater person, like bursting out in a song at lunch if you're going to be an actor in high school. I was just like, I will never be those people. You know, that was my... But so I just feel like your persistence is what... And just showing up every day, showing up at the bus stop, writing whatever it may be. You may write screenplays for 10, 15 years and then show up on set and then you realize instantly, oh, I'm a producer.
Yeah.
Or I don't even like writing. You know what I mean?
Wow.
I mean, that stuff happens all the time because these are jobs that you can't experiment with. You know what I mean? You can't on the big level. Now, I am a big proponent of people experimenting with them at the small level. Like, I don't think working your way up is a good way to go, you know?
I know. When I was a kid, I was a child actor, but like you, I don't think I was, look at me, you know, the sun will come out. Like, I was just not that person.
Yeah.
I was just like a quiet kid, but I really loved acting.
They probably loved you because you weren't
bursting out
into song.
I know, but my parents did not want me to get in the industry, so they were like, we're not taking new auditions. Like, so I thought I would study theater in college and all that, and then I thought, I'm just going to work on a set, you know, during my summer and intern. And then I realized, I like all these other jobs more. Like, you know, and it's just, you have to explore your way a little bit. But I think the persistence thing is maybe why so few women are producing, directing, writing. It's because I think they try, and I think women are conditioned to not take risks. And if someone tells them this sucks, they'll be like, oh, it's not perfect. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm going to go away now.
Right, right.
Men are, from an early age, you're supposed to ask the girl out. You're supposed to persist, get up.
You're supposed to get rejected and then do it again.
Right.
And yes, women are supposed to say yes or no,
and
ma'am,
be perfect.
And
yeah.
be perfect and accept what is handed.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, the girls got to be persistent and learn from the dudes and just keep being, be the annoying jerk that keeps asking the girl out. Like, just don't give up.
I think it does work on some level. Like, just putting yourself out there. I mean, I don't know. It's just... But I didn't even have that. I didn't have, like... I could never ask anyone for anything. Like, I just basically kept making movies until finally one of them didn't suck. That's it. I mean, it was just like sadly, desperately making movies.
But to me, like, I don't know, I'm probably 100% wrong, but this is from an outsider, non-writer kind of perspective. Like, it feels like writing there's like a finite, you can only get so good at it if you're not good. You know what I'm saying? Like, with acting, I feel like you could do the classes and you can, you know, be in a bunch of shitty plays and da 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 and make yourself an amazing actor.
Yeah.
But I don't, for some reason, for me anyway, there's like a wall with writing where it's like, at the end of the day, you're either really a good writer or not a good writer.
Really?
But, yeah.
I don't feel that way.
Okay.
But I'm a writer, so.
I think it's murky too. But I mean, the hard thing about writing is that you need someone to believe in you so that they produce your work.
That's it.
That's the hardest part is that you're just inherently in a massive gatekeeper scenario. Like, I mean, if you're a filmmaker, I think that's I think this is interesting. This is probably like inside baseball on filmmaking, but you know, we are conditioned to think that a screenplay is a finished piece of art. And I do regard it as that as a person, But in the world, a screenplay is basically like a third or a half of a piece of art. So yeah. you're kind of like shackled by the fact that you're only one of three or halfway there at best.
Yeah.
And, you know, at least as a director making movies on DV, when that 24 frame DV camera came out, like at least I could complete my films, you know, and I could, they were done. And whether or not there were still plenty of gatekeepers, but if it was bad, it was bad. And if it was good, it would move on. It would get somewhere, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that's what's really tough about writing is that people, even really seasoned writers, like forget that it's not done. It's,
oh, yeah.
it's just the beginning here. And it's a really tough, vulnerable place to be, I think.
Like, the thing that kind of, like, it doesn't ruin movies for me at all, but after I worked, like, as a PA on a movie and I started writing movies, I noticed how many people work on a movie and how many parts to this machine there is.
Yeah.
So when I watch a bad movie, I have a really hard time shitting on it because I'm like, we don't know. Like, maybe just they got the wrong director, the wrong actor, the wrong script.
There's so many things that have to go right in a movie for it to be good. And,
yeah.
and one, you know, let's say there's 20 core things that have to go right. I mean, there's 1,000 elements.
Yeah,
but even if there's only 20, if one of those key elements is off, your movie's not going to work.
Yeah, and it sucks when you just, it's not in your hands, but you yeah. wrote it or you directed it
yeah.
and your name's on it.
It's brutal. I mean, it's totally brutal. I mean, I think that's why, as a director, like, that's why people fight so hard for control and why it's kind of important to come up from the ground up because, you know, if you're doing it as like a handmade piece of art and something is not right,
yeah,
your alarm bells will go off. That is if you're centered and you are driving forward with what you think you know you want to do. All this is super complicated, but your alarm bells will go off. You may not know how to fix it or what's wrong, but at least you can say something is very wrong. Like something is very wrong with this performance. I'm not saying this actor is an asshole. It might be because he's an asshole. It might be because he's moody today. It might be this. I don't really know what it is. And I think the persistence of that is why like Paul Thomas Anderson doesn't make bad movies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's just doggedly tracking everything down. You know, like I know enough to know that shit goes wrong in his movies and the dude doesn't leave set until he fixes it or until he finds a workaround or whatever. But it is so hard to do that because there's hundreds of people who just want you to say, yes, we got it. We can move on.
Yeah. I mean, is that, I haven't been in the business long enough to know, but is that something that like when you make a studio movie, for example, is that, I would imagine it to be way harder because there's so many people you have to please.
Yeah, yeah. You have to like hold them off.
Yeah.
Like, it's like dogs like trying to kill you.
Right.
And you're just holding them off and you're like, I know how much this costs, but this we cannot leave because
yeah.
it's not right. Like this is a key scene and it didn't play out the way that we thought it did. And the way that it played out does not serve the story. And I know that we don't have this car anymore. And I know that we lost this actor. So I'm going to take 20 minutes and rejigger this scene. And then I'm going to use what's available in front of me to make a scene that fulfills it so that the movie can like move forward and we don't have a big hole. And then you're wondering why our climax isn't making people cry the way that we expected it would is because these building blocks were not here. I mean, this is just like so inside baseball, but like it is more about persistence and
yeah.
it is about just like staying focused. It's not about being like cocky or like you know everything. I mean, in my experience, when I've been directing and I've had those moments, it's because I don't know. But it's similar to when I made shitty movies. At least I knew that they were shitty.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't thinking that I took a crap and it was golden and it was beautiful and
right.
it smelled great. Like I was like, yeah, this is a big pile of diarrhea, and we have to make chocolate cake before we leave, and I don't know how to do it. So
yeah.
let's figure it out.
I mean, and
what
luckily,
a visual.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I like that. It's
but like,
very
luckily,
descriptive.
Like,
while you're a writer. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's like you had your brother to be like, hey, does this suck? You
yes, because your internal dialogue can be externalized, which helps a ton.
Right. And I feel like when I work mostly by myself, but like I'm writing a movie right now with someone else, and I feel like I couldn't write a movie alone at the moment because I need the someone else to just validate this is the right choice we're right. making, right? Yes. Right. Okay, let's move. And I trust her taste.
Yes.
So like we can move on. But I feel like that, you know, with big budget movies, they get so lost. There's like 80 heads to please.
Oh, yeah, because it's not a movie. It's yeah. It's a commodity.
And I wonder,
they're
though.
They're serving the commodity, not the not the fine cut piece of art that's going to be on screen.
But you probably know better than I do. Like, if you look at the last like 5 years, maybe like most of the things, most movies that won like the best Academy Awards and all this were made independent filmmakers, very low budgets.
Yes.
When will the studios like wake up to like maybe we just let them do their own shit and we produce it, but we will just
because those movies don't make money,
jump through hoops.
I think that's why. Is I mean, some of them make money, but like the really thoughtful movies, that's true.
Yeah,
I mean they can, but I would just, I mean, you know, like,
I wonder if this is just a shift in the tide of the whole system.
I would love it. I mean, you know, movies used to be better in yeah. general. I mean, there just used to be a lot more good movies. But I mean, I think the truth is like the tentpole situation just pays off more.
Yeah.
And that's what people go to movie theaters to see. Like even like Lady Bird, which is a great film, like people don't feel the need to do that on a Friday or Saturday night. They'll wait for Netflix. They'll wait for iTunes or whatever. Like people will blow money on another, Action. Yet another Marvel movie. Yeah.
Absolutely.
How many
Although,
do we need?
That lesbian one I'm in for.
Yeah.
Which one's that?
You've not seen the girl that like edited it? I'll show you later in post. But yeah, totally.
Yeah. It's definitely like, I don't know. It's a little bit scary. I mean, I think it's just like the way that people like to consume movies. They don't want to spend a Friday night or a Saturday night unless it's going to be a hugely entertaining, like blowout. That's exactly what they expect. Like
yeah.
when you go to see yet another Marvel movie, you're like, I know what I'm getting.
Yeah,
I'm going to get a lot of action. Structure. I'm going to get some romance. I'm going to get some weak jokes.
Right.
I'm going to, like, I'm not going to worry too much. I'm going to, and I'm going to leave feeling empowered in a really shallow way. Now, am I commenting a little too strongly?
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like,
I like it.
Yeah. I can't deal.
Can we back up for 1 second?
Yeah.
So when you do write like the puffy chair, when do you know that your baby is beautiful?
When other people tell me that it is.
Okay, so it really is relying on, yeah. everything's about other people.
I have feelings. I mean, now, you know, after so much failure, I know how to write a scene that is something that I uniquely have to offer. At that point in time, we were in our mid-20s. We were in relationships, and everyone that we knew was in that relationship where you're like, okay, we've been doing this for 2 years. We're in our mid-20s. We either need to break up or get married.
Yeah.
What are we going to do, fart around for 20 more years? And everyone was feeling that, the guys and the girls.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously people have different perspectives on it, but it was a thing that was happening. And we were like, okay, this is what we have to offer. Also, all we have is a van and an apartment. You know what I mean?
Right.
So like this is our yeah. available material school of filmmaking, you know? So, you know, you write the scenes, and we had had enough success with our short films at Sundance and festivals and stuff where we're like, we had a relationship with our audience. Like, you know, we had been to Sundance 2 times in a row. We'd been to Berlin. We won a bunch of awards. We went all over the world showing people our movies and watching them watch our movies. And we're like, oh, they like that. They like it when we make fun of ourselves. They like it when we look pathetic. They like this. They like that. And, you know, so I think being in touch with your audience is a huge, huge part about it. Is like, even if you're a writer, like, you know, seeing how people react to your work, reading it on Twitter, like going to screenings when they have public screenings, just so you can watch an audience watch your stuff
yeah.
and contextualize it. So I had some ideas about which scenes would be good. You're wrong a lot of the times.
Yeah.
They love other things and they don't like the things that sure. you love. But I had some feelings, but not until strangers come up and say, I fucking loved your movie. I cried so hard. I laughed so hard. I felt like you had a microphone in my apartment.
Huh.
When people say that, you're doing good.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
hundreds and hundreds of people. Until hundreds and hundreds of people are being moved deeply by your movies, keep fucking working at it. And even when they are, keep fucking working at it. I mean,
yeah.
that's the thing about like the kids who think that their shit doesn't stink is like, you know, really listen to your audiences and what they're telling you. Listen to what they want from you, you know, and it wasn't always perfect. It's never been perfect, but like people would say certain things to us, like, I don't know, you know, they were just like, oh yeah, like our early movies were like mostly like male perspective. And I was like, yeah, because I'm a dude and this is what I know. And I'm just like barely, I mean, like when I made the puffy chair, it was like, I was just trying not to make a total piece of shit. It's like, please God, don't let it be super shitty, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, I have something to offer. But, you know, as I grew and as I got, like when we made our TV show for HBO Togetherness, which is a real two guys, two girls, four-hander.
Which I loved and felt like, I remember I was in Detroit doing like a speaking gig when I heard the news that it was canceled.
Oh.
And there was a thing in my Holiday Inn Express and it had like, oh, HBO, and it had like a Togetherness thing, and I was just like crying. I was like, no.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. But just so you know, because like, you know, people telling you, I love that work. I loved Togetherness so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, for that show, you know, I knew it was critical to have female perspective. So we like hired female writers. Like the only writers Mark and I wrote pretty much everything, but we had a small writer's room of two more people and there were two women writers because we just needed that perspective. I mean, obviously we're like talking to our wives the whole time about it and about the representation and about how it feels and whether that feels right. But also just like having women like talking about storylines and stuff, because your brain, I mean, I'm a dude. That's, you know, the way I generate things, and I learned a ton through that process, and I think it made the art way, way better.
Yeah. You know? It's good to be inclusive.
Yeah. And I also feel like you have to wait till, you said strangers. I think that's really the key, because I've been to some premieres before. The premiere is like the biggest smoke blowing.
Yes.
I've been to some really horrible movie premieres. Like the movie was terrible. The second the movie starts, it doesn't matter. Like the worst joke gets 100 laughs. Yeah. Like it's artificial.
It's casting crew.
It's so you feel bad actually at some points. You're like, this is bad, and people are like, I don't know. People are like forcing the. There's always one lady that's like, ha! Like,
yeah, oh, that's the wife of the guy who said the line for sure. Yeah. Have you not experienced this, Eden?
I went to the I, Tonya premiere, which was a good movie. I don't feel blowing smoke at all, but I was curious. I knew that Tonya Harding was in the audience.
Yeah.
So I was looking for her the whole time to see her reaction to the movie.
That's all I'd be doing is watching her watch the movie.
I was like, where's Tonya Harding? And that's all I'm doing the whole time. Like, where is she? I want to see how she's taking this in. Because that's a good critic, you know.
I saw that movie, that's all I thought about for like months.
What is she thinking?
It's like, how has this affected her?
Yeah.
It's so profound.
She seemed really happy, actually. So
that's great.
I think she's happy with it. But yeah, like your mom is going to tell you, things great. I love you, honey.
Yeah, of course. And your friends are going to tell you that, too. No one's going to tell you the truth about it. But, you know, if your movie goes to a movie theater and you go to, like, the Lemley 7 in Pasadena and a bunch of old people sitting watching your movie.
Do you do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Awesome. You know when they laugh and when they like it and when they don't and when they walk out. You know. There's nothing. They're not doing you any favors. They're not there to like, you know, make you feel good.
No,
they paid money.
Huh. And they're old. They're relentless.
And they don't give a fuck.
They don't have much time to live. They're not going to waste their time.
They'll scoot over. They'll sashay from theater 5 to theater 6. No problem
that's
whatsoever.
That's like what I did when I was 12.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Some of my friends just got caught doing that. I never thought it was possible to get caught. But yeah, some of my friends just got caught doing that very same thing. You mentioned you love acting. But you didn't realize it until... Did you not realize it till later in life? Or you just never really pursued it hard until later?
I never thought I would like acting. Because, like, I think... Like, I was... That anecdote about, like, theater kids in high school bursting out in a song was true. And I think there's, like, a whole side of acting. And a lot of actors are into attention.
Mm-hmm.
They're into... And I hate that as a director, and I'm always seeking out actors who don't want attention, so they're just behaving. But it never occurred to me that, like, I don't know, that I would just be put in front of a camera and just do things and it would work. I mean, it really took Jill Soloway, like, forcing me to do Transparent. Like, I was trying to avoid it at all costs because I was just about to make Togetherness and I was really stressed out. And she was like, you're my Josh. She's like, this family is not complete without you and I will fight to the death to get you in this thing. And I was like, why? I was like, I'm not even an actor. I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, I just need you to like say his words and be you, and it'll work.
That's what's so interesting. But, yeah, I think about not just transparent, but I think most of the roles that you play, they feel like they're real people. It's not an actor playing this person.
Yeah.
And I think what Jill saw in you was like, oh, him, his whole, like, he just needs to say these lines because this is the person I see.
Yeah. The energy is there for her. Yeah. And then it evolved over five seasons or four seasons, but like, I definitely like, I don't know. I mean, I think I had a lot that worked out for me in terms of, I mean, obviously I like walked into what I think is one of the best TV shows that have ever been and just walked in sideways. I mean, all my actor friends hate my guts and they should. I feel really bad. But I also, there were some things about it that, you know, she told me later too. Like, I'm not, first of all, movie sets are, and TV sets, they're nerve-wracking places, but yeah. I've lived on them for 20 years and I'm not nervous on a movie set. Like, I just don't, I've dealt with like wildly famous actors. So it's just like, just being in the world, it wasn't nerve-wracking to me. I was just like, okay, I'm just here to not fuck it up. That's what I'm here to do. Yeah. And I had no agenda. I didn't need to be entertaining. I was just like, Jill, just tell me what to do. I'll fucking do it, you know?
But wait, let's back up just for a split second. You're at a party with Jill.
Yes.
And you start suggesting people for the role.
Yeah, she was like kind of desperate because she's like, I'm making a family show and I have everyone in the family except for the son. And I'm freaking out because we're supposed to go soon. And, you know, I basically need a wildly charismatic / wildly insecure mid-30s Jewish guy. And I was like, I know all of them. They're all my friends. Yeah. And I was like trying to push Krumholtz on her like really hard. Like, I'm such a Krumholtz fan and I think he's got like untapped magic and power in there. And she's, and I was, but I just went through like probably 30 names. And she was like, no, I've thought of them. It's not right. It's not right. And then we kept talking and we were just like really hit it off. Mm. And then she stopped and she was like, it's you. She's like, you're it.
You've been punked.
And I was just like, Jill, I'm not a player. Like, I mean, I joke that like Josh has had sex with more people in season one of Transparent than I've had in my entire life. I'm like been with my wife for 17 years. I have two kids. Like, I'm a fucking domesticated, like dorky writer director.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, you're not. And I'm like, yeah, I am. And she's like, well, just put yourself inside of Josh. And she put me in those outfits and that hair and like, and you know, I mean, I don't know. There was like some kismet with Gabby and Amy and like just a natural, I mean, basically what happened is I'm not interested. I don't want to do it. And she said, just come in tomorrow and read with these people who will be your sisters. And I went and I read with her and we read like the barbecue scene from the pilot. And there was just, it was one of those times where like, I don't know, electricity was happening, like lightning was striking in that room, and it was good and it was funny and I was like fucking with them and like siblings do.
Yeah.
And it turns out in retrospect, like we, Jill, Gabby, Amy and I, we all have siblings who are essentially our soulmates. Mm-hmm. So it's like she knew there's so many weird coincidences because the way that Jill built that cast was not based on casting. It was based on, she built a family that she felt was real. So real. I mean, I'm getting chills talking about it because like Gabby and Amy and I hang out all the time and people are freaked out when they see us on the street and people have asked.
They're real. They're a family.
It's real. Yeah. And people have asked if Gabby and I are like brother and sister and we're like, it's TV. You know how it works, but we kind of are.
Yeah.
And we've been through so much together. So the way that she built it was much more profound than casting a TV show.
Yeah, she really casted a family.
Yeah, she made a family and then she turned the camera on.
That's crazy. That's amazing. And then Outside In is like your latest acting
thing. Yes, I star in a movie with Edie Falco, which is insane.
That's awesome.
That statement alone is totally insane.
She's baller. I love her.
She's so baller and she's the coolest lady in the world. And we were like shooting in like upstate Washington and it was cold and
it
wet
cold Washington.
And hard and we had no trailers and she was just like hanging out in a VFW knitting and being the most pleasant person in the world. She is cooler than you think she is.
Wow.
Is that possible?
It is. Doesn't seem possible, but it's like we were just freaking out the whole time and also delivering just like incredible performances at every turn.
I don't think she could say a line unbelievably.
She can't. She won't do it. Yeah. She just, she's just one of those people who just, she just...
But you co-wrote it too, right?
Yeah, I co-wrote the movie with Lynn Shelton, the director.
That's great. So how is that seeing your work all of a sudden? Because this is like, you're not only starring in it, which is new, you're you're like, you wrote half of it. It's like a big hand in the pot. How is it like seeing it come out and all that stuff?
It's very surreal. It's a super vulnerable movie to watch me do. I play a really crazy, vulnerable character, needy, desperate, mangy. He's a guy who's been in prison for 20 years and gets out and just has no life skills whatsoever. And I did a ton of research and like just met a bunch of guys who had been through some stuff like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to wonder, like, how did you come up with the concept? Did Lynn?
No, it was Lynn's. Lynn was obsessed with me on Transparent. She was just like, I can't stop watching you on Transparent. And I was like, okay, cool. I like that. And she's like, I'm going to make something with you. And then eventually, and I was like, yeah, I'm in. You know, it's Lynn Shelton. And then eventually she said, okay, here it is. You go to jail for 20 years when you're 18, and the only person who takes care of you is your teacher, and she becomes, you know, she continues to educate you, and then she advocates for you, and then you guys fall in love and to varying degrees of awareness. Mm-hmm. And when you get out, you pursue her relentlessly. And I was like, I'm in, let's make this movie. So she wrote a draft, and then she's like one of the busiest TV directors out there. You know, we were going to make it sort of old school mumblecore-ish, sort of like mostly improv. But the more that we dug into it, the more that we realized like how fucked up the American justice system is and how important it is to actually get this right. And so I just ended up researching like crazy and ended up, and then I was like, hey, Lynn, I know you're going to do this TV show. Can I write the next draft? And she was like, yeah, please. And so we ended up trading drafts and then made this movie.
What's the biggest lesson that you learned? Like, what did you think that you, that turned, like maybe you had a different opinion on that might've, is there any piece of that?
I think the biggest turning point for me was that, you know, we've all seen movies where dudes come out of prison, they're super hard and they're angry and they're like just wrecking things constantly. Mm-hmm. And I'm like a little dude and I'm like not violent in nature and I have a lot of emotions. You know, I mean, that's probably like why I like acting is like, you know, I'm the guy in my family where everybody's like, can you stop feeling all the feelings so much? Aww. You're making us uncomfortable. And now I'm like, I'm getting paid to have the fucking feelings.
Fuck you.
Yeah. And so I was nervous about it. I was like, I'm not hard. Like, am I going to have to get hard? Like, what is it going to be? And then so I was like, okay, get it out of my head. And I started meeting all these guys and there definitely was some hardness, but it was weird. It was like, I actually had a totally different experience of these guys. Mm. Maybe it was me being in relationship to them, but like the things that I experienced in them were they were scared to death because once your freedom has been taken from you, all of them express the fact that, and I say it in the movie at some point, where you just feel like they're just going to come get you and put you back in. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it because that's your mentality after that time. So they're fearful, but they're also like so excited to be in this world and so, and also super excited to like the potential of like a genuine relationship, mm-hmm. not even romantic, just anyone who shows you love or kindness is like so overwhelming.
Yeah.
Like they almost get giddy. And so when I started to feel that, I was like, oh, that I can do that. I can do like a person who's just like so needy, but just so has so much love to give. And so that's once we started seeing that, that's how we started writing that character. And it actually fueled the relationship part with Edie that much more because
it felt real.
She was in a loveless marriage and this kid is just like full of love and just like totally charging dead on at her the whole time. And it's real. I mean, who knows if it'll last or what it'll be, but like, it's so genuine and it's so undeniable. And, you know, that's kind of what the movie is about. It's like, can she resist it? And what I think is interesting about the movie too, is that although it seems like it's the story of like a kid coming out of prison and what he goes through, the movie sort of becomes her movie in the second half. And I think the movie kind of becomes more about like, does a middle-aged mother deserve a chance to be happy or to make choices or freedom.
Yeah.
And I think like the more that Lynn and I explored it, I think the answer culturally in America was fuck no.
Yeah.
Fuck no, especially in middle America. It's like, yeah, no, you don't get that. And so we were like, let's challenge that. Let's challenge that reality and create a character where people want to root for her to take a chance to be happy. So
she was in her own prison.
She was in her own prison.
Yeah.
Nice. We should have.
That should have been the tagline.
She was in her.
Well, when I
she
saw
was
the
in
movie,
her own prison.
Like, oh, she's also inside coming out of something. He's also living in a thing, constraints with freedom and all that stuff.
Yes.
This is why their love is like really powerful.
Yes.
And how can we see Inside Out right now?
It's on Netflix now.
Netflix.
There you go.
iTunes.
Interesting on Netflix though. I didn't know this until like I was like looking at my Netflix on my phone and it shows stuff you've watched and it's not even your face on the movie thing. It's Edie Falco's face.
Well, do you know why?
Why?
It's because that's your preference.
Oh.
I don't know if you know about this, but Netflix, when you deliver a movie to Netflix now, you submit like 12 images. And depending on who you are, you might see a middle-aged lady who's like having a hard time. You might see you might see a guy on a BMX bike in a wide shot with a mountain in the background. Huh. You might see my face. You might see Caitlin Dever's face.
Yeah, interesting.
It is wild.
I can't wait to find out what I see.
You probably know so many secrets about Netflix that we're not even going to get into, but you can write a book about it.
I know some secrets, but that's one of the cooler ones. Yeah. Like, go. Like, what's really interesting is, like pick a movie that you love and then have all your friends take a picture of the thumbnail of what the movie looks like, and you might see 12 different representations of that movie.
Huh.
They know how to push your buttons or to get
blew
you to
my
push
mind
their
just
buttons.
Now. That's interesting.
Yeah.
I
got to do this.
I gave my writing partner my Netflix password because she forgot hers. And now I'm like, all these shows, now it's going to be her preference.
She's fucking up your choices.
I know.
You know, you can have like 4 accounts on one account for free.
Yeah, I don't know who owns my HBO Go. I think it's someone's mom. I'm not sure.
Oh, no one's paying for HBO.
I'm no one's paying
I know.
HBO
I have
Go.
Somebody else's HBO Go too. I guess I should
say
that.
There's like 52 people above the ages of 70 who have HBO accounts, Go accounts, and then everyone else is drafting.
You're like, mom, dad, can I just have your password?
How about we just get Elon Musk to pay for everyone's HBO Go?
I think it's
How's
fair.
That?
I think it's fair.
Distribution
when we made HBO at Togetherness, we used to joke in press that like we were still using our parents' HBO Go accounts. HBO Go accounts, and like the execs at HBO were just like laughing with us. It was funny.
That's great.
Just kidding. So one other question here. You and you made me think of it because you said Alon Gale today tweeted.
Yeah, he was one of our guests.
Yes, he wrote just took a long airplane ride. He watched a bunch of movies and he read a book. And that book is called Like Brothers.
Like Bros.
That you wrote with your brother.
Yes.
What's that about? Is it just about being brothers?
Yeah, we were approached by Random House to write a book, and we were like, we're busy, and we make movies. Why are we going to do that? And they were like, because it's cool. And so then we asked some of our friends, like, what's it like when you write a book? And they're like, it ruins your life. And we were like, I don't want to
do
that. But Mark really wanted it, actually. Mark is definitely more into writing, and he was like, yeah, let's do this. Like, I mean, there are definitely projects where, like, I'm leading or he's leading, and he really wanted it. I was like, okay, let's do this book. And I think at first we were like, what's worth saying anymore? Like, has anything been said? But I think it started with the fact that a lot of younger filmmakers do look up to us, and you know, it was a place to galvanize all that information and also talk about similar to here, like how we came up and how we had literally no connections to Hollywood and how we like sort of built a body of work that eventually made its way into the system and started, you know, getting paid to make movies. So, and then the other thing that came out that we didn't think we'd go deep with is just like the evolution of our relationship and, you know, us being super close and then working so hard together and that sort of being really stressful and kind of compromising our brotherhood and friendship and how we work to, on our own marriage, I guess, to like, you know, stay close to each other.
That's so how was writing a book? Was it as bad as
it's exhausting, stressful. You wonder why the fuck you're doing it. And then it comes out and you're like, oh, I guess this, I don't know. I mean, the great Judith Light, as I was like, one day I was like, I don't know why the fuck we're doing this. This is annoying. I'm like in the middle of working here. And she's like, because people asked you to write it and because the world wants to read your book.
Yeah.
And she's like, that's why you do it. And I was like, oh, right. It's what I tell all the other kids. I mean, that's what I tell people when they're like, should I move to LA? My answer is don't move to LA until you're invited. You'll know when it's time to move out to LA is when, you know, like people are like, hey, come here and direct this movie. Or
I'm still not invited. I was born here. So I was
so
just,
right, you're just,
I'm squatting.
Just lurking, yeah. Loitering.
But I think your book really did help at least show younger filmmakers that, hey, this is possible. You don't have to be, you know, so-and-so's like son in order to.
No, you also don't have to be a fucking genius.
Yeah.
I mean, like P.T. Anderson is a fucking genius. We're like genetic B minuses.
No.
You know what I mean? And like with persistence, we figured out what it is that we had to offer. I mean, we wanted to be the Coen brothers forever. It turns out that our style and what we have to offer is kind of the opposite of the Coen brothers. Like, we're kind of sloppy documentary style, like very human, feeble, like low stakes storytelling. And it took 10 years to get the Coen brothers out of my system to finally just be like, all right, this is who I am. A guy who can't get his answering machine message right and has a nervous breakdown. Enjoy.
Perfect.
That is perfect. And I mean, I really love the overall theme that I feel from you, which is just keep at it. If it hasn't happened for you yet, just keep at it.
Essentially. Yeah,
keep showing up.
Keep showing up.
Let's ask our last question.
Our last question that we ask everybody, which is, do you have a favorite charity?
What is my favorite charity? My favorite charity, I don't know if this counts. I mean, I have proper charities, but I think my favorite charity is Kickstarter.
Wow, okay, good.
Is just like supporting people in the projects that they do.
How do we do that one?
That would be difficult, though. Okay,
All right.
Do you have a Kickstarter that you are backing right now?
I'm sure I have a Kickstarter that I'm backing, but I wouldn't be able to retain the knowledge of what has been made and what hasn't.
I'm just going to give it. I'm going to give away, what I usually don't give away is we give money to charity, your favorite charity.
Oh, you guys.
Show. So do we want to give $100 to a Kickstarter campaign, or do we want to give it to, like, you know, I don't know, Starving Children?
I would say Trevor Project.
Let's give
it to Trevor Project.
Project, it is $100.
Yeah,
on behalf of
we do good
Jay
here.
That's good
Thank
stuff,
you so
you
much.
Yeah,
Jay, we really enjoyed having you on the show.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, guys.
Everyone, for listening.
Thanks, guys. Bye bye.